Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm John Eltz, a documentary filmmaker and director of the documentary program at the Graduate School of Journalism at Berkeley. I'll be your chairman and moderator for today's program. It's particularly gratifying to have walked in this room today and see the faces of all these young filmmakers, many of whom were not born when Albert was inventing what we now do. And it's great to see folks here to carry on that struggle. Albert and David Maisels were the first Americans to make documentary feature-length films for theaters, major nonfiction stories in which they would allow life, intimate, joyful, sometimes catastrophic, messy human drama to unfold on the fly, unrehearsed, unscripted, and without second takes. He began in 1955 with a wind-up 16-millimeter camera, and he was, in fact, inventing on his own most of the techniques which we now teach in film school. In 1960, on primary, an intense behind-the-scenes look at the Kennedy-Humphrey Democratic primary, Al's extraordinary gifts as a handheld cameraman burst forth, and I have to say all the rest of us have been trying to attain that standard ever since. Then came Salesman, most unlikely masterpiece. The Maisels recorded a riveting and startlingly pure portrait of four door-to-door Bible salesmen as they made their weary way up and down the East Coast of the United States. Then in 1969 came Gimme Shelter. It's a dazzling narrative of the Rolling Stones tour of America, which ended with a descent into chaos and murder at the now legendary Altamont Free Concert. Next came Grey Gardens, about the life of two reclusive and aging and eccentric cousins of Jacqueline Kennedy in their falling down dilapidated mansion in the Hamptons. Grey Gardens is certainly the only documentary I know of that's been made into a Broadway musical. Albert's most recent work is The Gates, which is a result of 25 years of doggedly filming the artist Christo. In his frustrated attempts to install 7,000 brilliantly saffron-colored banners in New York's Central Park. Christo finally did succeed, and the film was released last year. Through all this, Albert says, and I quote quite simply, "I put my faith in reality. Reality is my caretaker." Over the years, I've worked with Al on several films, and I can testify that, in fact, reality really does watch over Albert Maisels. Please welcome Albert Maisels.
Thank you so much. For documentary filmmakers, and for all of us, I think, it's the best of times and the worst of times. The best of times for documentary filmmakers is represented by the fact that things seem to be moving from fiction to nonfiction, certainly in literature, and there's a significant acceptance of documentary now more than ever. On the other hand, we're all faced with mass media that are so determined to depict whatever is lousy about life. We have a History Channel devoted to war. You don't know this, perhaps, but CNN now has a new channel. It's the Military Channel. It's time that we had a Peace Channel. And I'm about to meet up with Mr. Kucinich, who has proposed that whereas we have a Department of Defense and a Department and the Pentagon, it's time that we had a Department for Peace. there's got to be a film there for me somewhere in that region. And in fact, I have in New York at this time, in Harlem, where my family has moved, we have a studio there with a movie theater, and we're teaching young kids how to make movies. And the movie theater is going to show a week of peace advocating films. This summer we're showing music films. We showed a whole week of Cuba films, of another week or two of Haitian films. The wonderful thing that has excited me all these years about documentary is that it shows us directly, puts us immediately in contact with the experience of other people, experiences of people that we never otherwise would know about. So it puts us in contact truthfully and really with the real world. It's so important that we do that. And in fact, it in itself is a way of bringing peace, because it's so easy to get into war with another country when you don't know who those people are. Those 600,000 or 800,000 Iraqis who died, the 2 million who had to leave their country. If only we had known of just one family, I don't know that we could have done what we did. Anyway, in 1955, I had that kind of idea of humanizing, as all of my films attempt to do, of humanizing Russia by going over there and filming something human. I was a psychologist, had been teaching psychology at Boston University, worked in a mental hospital, so it was only natural for me to try to get into mental hospitals in Russia. And it's a long story. I crashed a party, met the top guys, one of them gave me a phone number, and I was all set. And I went around filming in mental hospitals and came up with my first film. But my purpose was to give us an opportunity to be on common ground with ordinary Russians. In fact, I heard a lecture that Margaret Mead gave, and the last words of her lecture were, "The most important thing is to satisfy our need and interest in finding common ground with one another." And I think I've made that point pretty strong. Again, getting back to the nature of the media in general, when my daughter was 4 years old, she's 32 now, when she was 4 years old, I remember taking her some evenings at 10 o'clock at night to pick up the New York Times for the next day, an early edition. We got to the newsstand one night, and the paper hadn't arrived yet. And she turned to me and said, "Daddy, the paper's not ready because the people haven't been killed yet." For relief from all that killing that I read in the first pages and the pages to follow in the New York Times, I find relief by reading the obituary claim page, at least those people who had died a natural death. Let's bring ourselves to life. Let's bring ourselves to examples of life, of happiness, illumination. Another complaint I have is for commercials, TV commercials. A waste of very talented cinematographers' time. Cars exploding, jumping around. Nothing that in praise of humanity, nothing to connect us with. If I were to make a Kleenex commercial, for example, I've got to propose this to the guys that do this. I would come to a hospital and wait for a woman to deliver her child. And when that child is handed over to her, I would start filming. There's got to be a moment when a tear descends from the eyes and there's a reach for the Kleenex. I think you've got the idea. That one commercial would cause so much disturbance, I think, in the commercial making public, that maybe they would use the opportunity not only to sell a product, but to give us a moment that is poetic. Something that has also inspired me to make documentaries is what Alfred Hitchcock said when he represented the fact that in a fiction film, the director is God. In a nonfiction film, in a documentary, God is the director. So if you let him do the work, if you let reality impose itself on the filmmaking process, then you're in good hands. And that's what I've always tried to do. I made a film for HBO of a very poor black family in the South. And there's some moments, a couple of moments that I'd like to recall for you to give you an idea of how you can so directly engage the public to know exactly what it is to be poor. There's a moment where Grandma, who's the main character, turns to her great-grandson, who's maybe 9 or 10 years old, and says to him, in effect, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And with a big smile on his face, he turns to his grandmother and says, "I want to be in prison." That's where all the men are. And of course, 80% of the prison population is of black people, mostly because of drugs, which should have been legalized years ago to take the crime and the profit out of it. We have a teaching program in Harlem where we teach kids how to make movies. And we've been teaching kids ages 8 to 12 how to make a movie. And each one of them makes a personal little movie, which we put on DVD and send to the parent who's in jail. We have such stupid laws in that regard. You may not know this, but there's a federal law right now where women incarcerated for 18 months or more lose custody of their children. Can you imagine anything more stupid for the child and for the parent? So there are a lot of things that are going on that we have to know about. And we have to know more, much more, about the good things that are happening. Tolstoy, at the beginning of Anna Karenina, made the statement that all unhappy families are unlike. Happy families are all the same. So that has given us, I guess, the journalistic prejudice of not paying any attention to happy families. If you see one, you see them all. But we need to have represented things of good that are going on, and we don't get enough of that. And I just met a woman the other day, 98 years old, a most interesting person who speaks so well about Judaism. She's the granddaughter of Shalom Aleichem, who is regarded as the Mark Twain of Judaism. And I was so impressed. I myself took about 6 years of Hebrew school as a child. I learned more about Judaism just in meeting her and learning about Shalom Aleichem. Well, she's going back, I think it's in October, she's going back to all those places in Eastern Europe where he was, and I'm going with her, I hope, and we'll film the best way I know how the story of Shalom Aleichem through her memories and through her visit. I'm making a film of little kids, ages 5 to 7, two at a time, friends or siblings, just talking to each other, out of the mouths of babes. I got interested in doing that from hearing a woman tell me of a friend of hers who has two kids, one 2 1/2 and the other only 2 months old. She overheard the 2 1/2 saying to the 2 month, "What's it like in heaven? I think I forgot." Another kid that I filmed, unfortunately I wasn't in on that one, but another kid that I filmed came up with the expression, "I solved my dream." Who else but a kid is going to be that poetic? During the election period, I filmed two Afro-American kids, one 6 years old playing the guitar, and the other one talking about war. "We could stop war," he said, "if only people would vote." Should have been a commercial for Obama. I don't know whether I've taken up all of my time. I got a few more minutes, and then we're going to go to Q&A. As you can see, there's a lot more work to be done. I'm 82 years old, and I'm still hoping to do a lot more. My dream film, which I will begin as soon as I can get the financing for it, because it's such a big project, and it answers so beautifully Margaret Mead's desire to find common interest. It's my train film. I call it In Transit. And I get on long-distance trains in half a dozen countries around the world. I'll go to Africa, South America. I've already done a little filming in America, but I'll do some more. The Trans-Siberian train, for sure. China and India. And it's not my just being on a train and talking to people and interviewing them. It's not that. I go beyond that, and I'll find somebody on each one of these long-distance trains when I'm filming them, discover that there's a story about to take place when they get off the train. So the film will be a collection of those short stories in those six countries. To give you an idea of the kind of thing I'm after, I took the train across America, going from California to New York. The train stops in Pittsburgh and picks up passengers. The train gets on to move toward Philadelphia. And as I walk through the train, I happen to come to the cafeteria coach, and I discovered a woman looked very nervous. Something's going on. So I asked if I could film her, and within moments I discovered why she was on the train. When she was 3 years old, her parents broke up in an ugly divorce, and she lost contact with her mother. She's 26 years old and never has seen her mother all of these years. She had just got a call the night before from a woman in Philadelphia. "I'm your mother. Get on the next train. I'll be waiting for you at the train station." I kept on filming. She arrived at the station, was about to walk up the stairs into the station itself when she saw a woman at the top of the stairs who threw open her arms, rushes down. They embraced, talked for quite a while, and then the mother turned to me and said, "Isn't she gorgeous?" Again, humanizing, bringing us in contact with people we'd never otherwise know. The perfect place for this is, as any of you would know who have traveled on a train, even on a bus and sometimes on a plane, meeting strangers, and strangers become friends. That is my goal always in what I do. Maybe it's a time for
I think
questions.
It's time for questions.
Is it, maybe you'd like to say something?
No, let me, first of all, thank you, Albert Maysles, documentary filmmaker. As you can imagine, we have dozens of questions here. Let me ask you, you know, over the years, thinking back, I realized that you were the first person I ever saw with a little tiny video camera. When we were all making films in the 1960s and 70s, we thought that the 20-pound 16-millimeter cameras were small and liberating. And about 10 or 15 years ago, I saw you with a tiny little Sony PD-150, I think. Do you want to talk about whether these new small video cameras have transformed, have they transformed what we do? Do they make it easier? Do they make it harder? Is there a downside? Is there an upside?
If you view my website, you'll see a list of 30 reasons why I've switched from film to video. And as you were talking about these small cameras, I remember a time in 1961 when I was with Cuba, and I had spent most of the day with Fidel Castro, and he said, "Tonight I'm going to the Chinese embassy. There's a reception there. You want to come along?" So, of course, I agreed. And there I was in the Chinese embassy with him, shoulder to shoulder, when a messenger came rushing in, handed him a telegram. He tore it open, and read it, turned to me and said, "Shall I translate it for you?" I said, "Please do." And I was without a camera. I would have had a little video camera with me for sure, and I would have got what he said. "Your State Department has just broken off relations with Cuba," which would have led me all the more to go back to Cuba, which I plan to go one of these days. I think he's in too bad a shape to be filmed, but I had done a lot of other filming in Cuba. A Cuban family that was given a new house, a very poor family, living on a dirt floor with no electricity or running water, filmed them as they were, filmed them moving into the new house, and then filmed them in the new house. That was 49 years ago. I want to go back and see what that family's like now.
Yeah, and with small video cameras, you could.
Yes.
Do you find ever that you tend to overshoot with small video cameras? Do you abandon your discipline?
Yeah. Henri Cartier-Bresson, the great still photographer, used a Leica camera, which had 36 exposures. I don't think that he would have shot any better with a 12-exposure camera. Whatever freedom you have with more and cheaper way of filming, you still have to be very discreet in order to get the good stuff. So if you're shooting at a higher ratio but end up with plenty of good material, fine. When I filmed three and a half-year-old children at breakfast time, hoping to end up with maybe 5 or 6 minutes of a sequence, I had a tape in my camera, which cost me $3. I shot for 40 minutes and ended up with a beautiful scene. What it was one of the children suddenly exhibited a strong liking for butter and insisted on more butter for the pancakes. And it just developed into this enormous display of passion for butter. There was a moment. It was a moment when the mother said, "But how much? I want that much more, more." And finally, the sequence ended with the child turning to her friend, saying, "If you don't eat more butter, I'll fight you." Things happen on their own, and if you're willing to wait and listen and watch carefully, you can end up with some wonderful, wonderful stuff. That poor family that I spoke of, the granddaughter, grandmother turned to her and said, "Look, it's 2 days now. You haven't gone to school. What's going on?" And in a voice just loud enough to be recorded, she said, "I don't have paper and pencil." You knew that much more about what it is to be poor.
Let me remind you, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we're talking with documentary filmmaker Albert Maysles, whose work includes Gimme Shelter and Grey Gardens. I'm John Els.
And salesman.
We have a number of questions. We have a number of questions about Gimme Shelter, which, for those of you who haven't seen it, is an extraordinary film. It really is a film about the end of the 1960s. and about the wheels running off of America at that point. And it's told through the story of the Rolling Stones' tour of America in 1969. And the central character, as you might imagine, is in fact Mick Jagger, who finally, in the last moments of the film, witnesses helplessly the murder of a young man during the concert at the Altamont Speedway. There's an interesting question here that never occurred to me. Do you think Mick Jagger learned anything from Give Me Shelter, from the film?
I only know from his character that I think he did, but I never got to talk to him about it.
Really?
I do know that when we finished the film, it was impossible to get a release from Mick and from the group. They just couldn't feel freed enough to do that. So obviously he was very disturbed by what had happened. 6 months went by, and my brother met up with a close friend of Mick. This close friend saw the film, said, "Don't worry, I'll talk to Mick," and we got the release. And we never had to change a single thing in the film. So he and the group had the courage to let the truth stand for what it was.
If I understand the story correctly, there was a coroner's inquest about that murder at Altamont, and in fact, your footage was used as evidence, and I think you may even have testified. I don't know if I've ever told you this, but about a year later, after Give Me Shelter was released, you and I worked together on a film about the Grateful Dead in San Francisco, and it was the first time that you and the Hell's Angels had been in the same spot, the same place, since the Altamont concert. And the crew, there was a great buzz among the crew that none of us wanted to stand next to you. None of us wanted to be near you because there was a rumor around that the Hell's Angels were going to try to do something to Al. And there were great debates among the crew whether we should all cluster around you to protect you or we should stay far away. I'm curious if in the wake of that film, or in the wake of any films, you felt a sense of personal danger or jeopardy.
Well, you get so involved in not missing a single thing that should be in the film that you're not afraid of anything. So in that sense, I was very fearless. When the film shooting was over, we thought, wouldn't it be interesting to take the film, the material of the killing, and show it to the police and film them watching it and commenting on it and doing the same with the Hell's Angels. So we got to the police, and they said, fine, and we got all that footage. And then we got to the Hell's Angels. They said, no, we're going to just look at it. And they looked at it, and they began to beat up on my brother. They wanted $1 million because they said they were live actors or something or other, something of that sort. And so we got out of there fast enough so that neither one of us got hurt. After the film came out, I remember going to a screening, and at the time of the killing, I heard in a couple of rows behind me some guys laughing, and I turned around, and it was Hell's Angels. You make a film of social significance, and the repercussions go on and on and on. And what you feel good about is that you told the story quite truthfully so that people could refer to that and know what really happened. To this day, there's no way of really knowing exactly what the purpose was, if any, on the part of the guy, Meredith Hunter, who held the gun when the Hell's Angel came upon him and stabbed him to death. So I might correct you by saying that you shouldn't really use the word murder. It was a killing for sure, but just what the motivation was, we never could find out.
Let me turn to Grey Gardens. And in Grey Gardens, as with all of your films, you extend enormous respect and deference, I think, to the subjects of your films. It's no secret that not all the critics agree with me on that. I'm curious, and it's come up in some of these questions, could you make a film about a bad guy, about a person whom you really felt was irredeemably evil? Could you handle Hitler or Pol Pot?
I'd love to. Especially since I had this experience some years ago. A very, very distinguished artist told me that in years bygone, he used to go to cafes in Berlin and Vienna, cafes that were attended by a number of very distinguished artists. And there were a couple of times when he saw this guy come in and sit down and get more and more ashamed, and it was Adolf Hitler. He couldn't quite measure up to the standards of the great artists that were there. And since then, I've read a book by a distinguished psychiatrist, a book on violence. And in that book, he stated that behind every person of violence is somebody who's lacking in self-respect and ashamed. That, of course, doesn't fully explain the horrible deeds of this guy, but it does, to some extent, view him as another human being, and we have to understand him in those terms. So I wrote a letter to Mr. Nixon. I wanted to make a film of him, who's not exactly my idol. And I thought that I could do a decent job, especially because my mother always gave me the advice, even before I was a filmmaker, there's good in everybody, and I would look for that, as I always do, even with somebody whose policies and character I'm not very fond of. My approach is completely different from that of Michael Moore, who is out to get somebody. And I'm out to understand them. And by understanding, love them. And by loving them, understand them.
It's a wonderful thought experiment to take home with you, to imagine a Maisel's film about Richard Nixon. I would say it's Mr. Nixon's loss that he might still be president today. If he had let you in. Well,
boy, it would take a lot to make Mr. Bush.
A lot to fix that.
To fix him up.
I want to follow up on Grey Gardens. The two lead characters in Grey Gardens are these two extraordinary women, Big Edie and Little Edie Beale, cousins in the Beauvoir family, I believe.
Aunt and cousin.
Pardon me?
Aunt and cousin.
Ah, okay. To Jackie, yeah.
Right.
Did the Beals see the film, and what was their reaction?
Well, we brought the film to Grey Gardens. We wanted them to be the first to see it. And when the film was over, Edie, in a very loud voice, after a couple of moments of pause, turned to us and shouted, "The Maisels have created a classic." Two years later, when Mrs. Beale was on her deathbed, Edie reported back to us those few moments with her mother, when she turned to her mother and said, in effect, "Is there something more you want to say?" And her mother said, "There's nothing more to say. It's all in the film." My only regret is that they're not around to see these musical, a Broadway musical, and the Hollywood film. I'm sure they'd have some criticism, but I think they'd like both.
What do you think of the musical? What happens when, you know, you start out with real-life events, you know, 25 years ago, and they end up in a film that you make, and then they end up migrating from the film to the musical stage, and now they've migrated to a feature film?
Yeah. Well, one thing that you shouldn't want to, and I don't want to control, is the reaction of anybody to that film. Everybody having a different frame, somewhat different frame of reference, is going to see something a little bit different in it. And so if somebody sees enough in it to do their Broadway interpretation or an HBO sort of Hollywood film, fine. I would go with that. On the other hand, I do get disturbed by several reviews where the reviewer felt that these two women were just too crazy to be filmed, that we were exploiting them because they were so crazy. I like to describe their eccentricity as they're just like anybody else, but more so. In fact, they show so many good signs of health, more so than many of their rich neighbors in the East Hampton community. They really do love one another. They don't watch television. They don't get drunk. They're up to date on their understanding of the world around them. And it goes on and on. But they did choose to be reclusives. They hadn't left the house in 20 years. They don't keep their grass cut nor their house clean. Over the years, they had something like 30 cats, not all at the same time, raccoons. We have to get used to people who are nonconformists. Some of them are some of our best people, and I have just the highest regard for them and a rather low regard for people like Walter Goodman, the reviewer in the New York Times, who said, "Why are they showing us all this flabby flesh?" You know, if a woman is over the age of 35, I guess you're not supposed to represent them in film. And then when Edie wrote this beautiful, understanding letter in response to his abnormal portrayal of the two women, they never published it. So I called up the editor of the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times and asked them if they'd received the letter. "Oh, yeah, we received the letter. And are you going to publish it?" "Oh, no, she's schizophrenic." Do we have categories of abilities or disabilities by which we disallow people from speaking their minds and responding to something in the paper? It's crazy. A normally very good reviewer, Molly Haskell, ended her review by saying, "They're just some people who shouldn't be filmed."
Is that true?
It's hard for me to imagine anybody who shouldn't be filmed. As long as there's something interesting going on that you feel needs to be filmed, then you'd want to do it.
Have you ever, in your filming, experienced moments when you felt, or the subject projected, such a need for privacy that you felt you had to remove yourself?
Lots of times when I put the camera down. But to illustrate how persistent I am trying to get what is at the heart of the matter, I remember filming a woman on the train. I was about to film her because she had this wonderful but very tragic and very personal and hurtful story of one of her children. And she didn't want to be filmed. But I was so eager to get it that as she spoke, I filmed her hands and got her conversation, which was fine for her, fine for me, and fine for the audience.
Wow. We have a couple of questions here about how you became what you became. Who inspired you? Who were your mentors? And who did you look to?
When I was 10 years old, I remember being in the public library doing my homework and being terribly bored by what I had to write. And so I searched around me. I discovered a book on one of the shelves, a book called Architects of Ideas, The Great Theories of Mankind. And there were chapters on Copernicus, on Malthus, on Darwin, you know, people like that. 16 of these people, none of whom I'd ever heard of. And there was one that I found particularly interesting, Sigmund Freud. you could actually scientifically analyze the human mind. Oh, my God. And so I became a psychologist. And psychology has helped me a lot in that I don't start out in making a movie determined to prove a point of view. Instead, I go at it with a completely open mind. And if I discover along the way that my initial ideas were prejudices that I should have dropped, I drop them and go for what I discover as I discover them. And the science of psychology has helped me out that way very much.
What about, were there directors that you admired whose work you stole from, borrowed from, sampled from, as we now say? I mean, I feel, yeah. You know, we all steal from you now, so we want to know who you stole from.
I don't go to the movies very much, but I have seen, fortunately, a number of the Italian neorealist school films, Rocco and His Brothers, and so forth. And I so greatly admire those films because I was so engaged with those people who came across being so real. And that has helped me, I think, in doing my documentary work.
It's no secret that if you get in a vehicle going to location with a bunch of documentary filmmakers, the subject will turn to funding within about 25 seconds. We get up in the morning and we go to bed at night worried about where our funding is going to come from for our next film. A question from the audience here. Did your films tend to be pre-funded, or did you just start making them in the faith that the funding would arrive?
Actually, Kimmy Shelter, Salesman, and Grey Gardens, the funding never came. Wow. We had to fund it myself. With one exception, we did get some funding, maybe 10% of the funding from the Rolling Stones when we got into making that film. But Salesman and Grey Gardens, we funded on our own. I'm in a position now where I can't continue to do that. And so I'm looking for funding for the train film especially, which will be very expensive, traveling to half a dozen countries and spending maybe 2 or 3 weeks on the trains and several weeks on each train story that just develops on its own. You might be interested, by the way, in knowing that in Grey Gardens we spent 6 weeks, in Salesman also 6 weeks, 2 weeks in filming the Rolling Stones, 3 hours in making a wonderful half-hour film of Marlon Brando. So it varies quite a bit.
I like the half-hour plan. It's, you know, an afternoon. I kind of like that. Well, you got a lot of nerve, I got to tell you. You know, as a documentary filmmaker, you got a lot of nerve to be out there with your own money on these projects that go on, in some cases, for years and years and years. Now, I don't know if most folks understand that most of your work has been outside of mainstream television. You do work with HBO.
Yes.
You did work with in the heyday of ABC documentaries with Robert Drew back in the early days, CBS. But generally, you've resolutely worked in theaters or doing films for the big screen in theaters. Have you ever tried recently to work within mainstream television? And do you think, I mean, would mainstream television tolerate Salesman?
15 years ago, the Rockefeller Foundation called me up and said, how would you like to go to North Korea? We have contacts there, and we'd love to send you there. So I said, oh, yeah, great. So off I went to North Korea. I got to Beijing, and I got word from New York, from the Rockefeller Foundation, that there was Tom Johnson, the president of CNN, was going to be on the same plane with me going to Pyongyang, capital of North Korea. So I thought, wow, what a wonderful opportunity to meet this guy. And the next day, I looked around in the waiting room at the airport, and I noticed the only Caucasian. I walked up to him, and I said, you must be Tom Johnson. Yeah. And I introduced myself. He said, oh, I know your work. But then there was no more conversation. I said, but aren't you interested in what I'm doing? I'm going to be looking into making a movie there. He said, oh, sure. I'm sure. No, we only do our own stuff. CNN only does its own stuff. ABC only does its own stuff. CBS does its own stuff. We don't realize it, but all those avenues for distribution are cut off to all of us independent people. What is it, that we can't make films decent enough for them? No, we make films better than what they show. Another one of my peeves I've let go.
Here's a simple technical question. What's the secret of getting people to open up on camera?
I love people. It's as simple as that. My wife, who's been a lifelong Catholic and who's now getting a PhD in early church history, has been so dismayed by her studies that she's now become Buddhist. And she told me that recently there was a whole group of some 30 pastors that went to London to get together, and the Dalai Lama was the speaker. He got up and said, "God loves, God loves, God loves. Love thy neighbor." That was his message. But through empathizing with people, really attempting to understand them, they pick it up, first of all, in my eyes, I'm sure. And I'm confident that I'm going to get something that really tells who they really are, what's going on. And they sense that. And I have very little problem getting access to people. I made a whole film of people getting hospice care and filming them at the very moment when that person was dying. I filmed people undergoing abortion. And I've done these things with such care and with such love that it's okay. And have no problem that way. There's something I think that people pick up in my eyes. I remember going to Cuba, getting off the plane, jumping into a cab, and turning to the cab driver and saying, "Where's Fidel?" And he said, "Oh, he's at a big auditorium addressing a big group of women." I said, "Take me there." I got there and put on an extremely telephoto lens because I was still maybe 20 or 30 feet away from him. And as I was carrying the camera up to my shoulder, he happened to look in my direction as he was giving this very strong speech. And we connected eyes to eyes, and I could tell from the way he looked back at me it was okay. And I carried the camera up to my shoulder and began filming. And that was the beginning of our friendship.
I've found, and I wonder if you've found over the years, as we moved away from the very large, very heavy, very bulky 16-millimeter cameras and the big video cameras to the smaller cameras, our own eyes and our own faces have re-entered the equation between us and the subject. In the old days, we were always, I was not a man, I was a body with a camera for a head. And now with the small cameras, we're able to hold, you know, these cameras weigh a couple of pounds, and they have a little flip-out screen on the side, so you can hold the camera slightly down from your face, and after decades of not maintaining eye contact with the people we're filming, we can actually look at them. And I found it enormously liberating.
You got it just right. You're not only seeing what you're getting, but from the viewfinder, but your eyes can depart from the screen and look at people in such a way that they feel, oh, okay, this guy knows what he's doing. And people go on being themselves. It's an enormous gift for the filmmaker who can make a film this way that he or she believes in and knows is true and knows is good. The subjects, from what I've indicated, they love what ends up as the film. And then there are millions of people who end up seeing it. There was a shot of me in the Oscar Awards, there was a little four-minute thing that I did that appeared on Oscar. 800 million people saw that show. So just a person like myself can have access to many, 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 many millions of people in theater, on television, DVD, the internet, one way or another, we can get our message across.
It's a lot of power, isn't it?
Enormous. And I feel a great responsibility in doing something that is correct and loving.
Here's a question from the audience, which is really about where that responsibility begins and ends. I'm sure that all documentary filmmakers can relate to this. Have you ever had your subjects seek personal help after filming? You get the phone call and your subject is just getting out of jail 3 years later. What do you do?
The poor family could have used a lot of help from us who made the film, but you certainly don't want to interfere with the process as you're filming. But in the case of that very poor family, I remember when the film got shown, I got a call from somebody in Georgia, the family's in Mississippi, and this woman said, I'm piling three or four of my friends in the car right now, and I'm going off to Mississippi to see what I can do to help them out. And they've gotten lots of help from various people who've seen the film. And that's probably the best way for it to happen.
Do you pay subjects in your films, either up front or as part of the profit participation? It's a big issue in documentary ethics these days. Should we pay people or not?
Well, you don't want to influence them by paying, and I suppose you want to save money too. but you try to avoid that. In the case of Grey Gardens, we made an exception, and we paid them. I think it was $10,000 each, and then they were to get a percent of the film, which they never got really because they died before the film had made any profit. But generally, it's not a good idea if you think that it might influence the results and getting them to feel especially obligated to be in the film. You want them to be in the film because they believe in it and they want to trust you to do a decent job.
I admire your reasonable flexibility on that issue, that vexing issue. Here's a question from the audience regarding Salesman. This person says, I've watched Salesman multiple times over the years, and I wonder if I've heard some of the dialogue looped by the subjects. That is, are there occasional off-camera lines that were added after the fact?
I can't remember that was so.
Yeah.
If I looked very carefully for that, perhaps I would find it, but I don't remember us doing that.
You and I were on a panel together in Los Angeles a couple of years ago with Werner Herzog, and Renner in that panel said that he wanted to be the gravedigger for cinema verite. Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
Perhaps, again,
illustrated my tolerance for difference of opinion. There were four documentary filmmakers who were nominated for the Oscar Award, and I was asked to make a little 30-second description of each one. One of them was Herzog, and so I met him on that occasion and made that little film of him, and we became very good friends.
This is another question about salesmen, combining several from the audience. Salesmen, for those of you who haven't seen it, is about guys selling Bibles, going around. They're not going around knocking on doors to save souls. They're going around knocking on doors to sell Bibles. And it's a film about the central text of Christianity, about this, you know, about the Bible. And yet, it's a film that in odd ways is sort of devoid of jubilation, and it's devoid of prophecy and of all the things we associate with religion. You never see the guys go to church. And that's part of the power of the film, is the contradiction between the book that they're selling and their lives on the road selling it. Were you aware of that at the time? Is it deliberate? Did they ever go to church?
They did go to church to meet possible customers. And the head of the Bible sales company, that was the only restriction that he put on filming. He didn't want us to represent that.
Oh, really?
Right. I think we did some of that filming, but we didn't show it. The Bible was sold for its color photographs, for its very expensive binding, you know, all of these sorts of things. I don't know, I don't think I mentioned it, but, or I may have. I met up with Oliver Stone and went to Venezuela and filmed Chavez with him. Yeah, I spent 3 days filming Chavez. And at that, one of those days, he turned to me, Chavez did, and said, of all the films that you've made, is there one that I should see? So I thought for a moment, he's been talking about capitalism being so bad and socialism being so good. I thought, you should see Salesman. So I sent him a DVD of it. I'm yet to hear back. I'm going to make every effort to see what his reaction may have been. He called me Albert Einstein, and I called him Victor Hugo.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with renowned documentary filmmaker Albert Maysles, whose work includes Give Me Shelter, Grey Gardens, and Salesman. I'm John Else. Your work always reassures us that we're getting the real thing. When I watch Maysles films, there's something incontrovertibly authentic about it. I can't say that for all documentaries, but for yours it's certainly true. Have there been times when you're working for instance, network executives or for funders, when you've been asked to, shall we say, cook the books, to fudge things, to fake things? Have you ever confronted that?
I don't know whether I have, but if I were to have been asked to do that, I wouldn't do so. The scary thing is that I probably could do a lot of filmmaking with outfits like the National Geographic, A&E, Bravo. I haven't even attempted to do so because they so insist on depriving the filmmaker of his independence and making the film conform to whatever kinds of plans they have for the film. And I don't want to sacrifice that kind of thing. With HBO, it's different. Sheila Evans is a filmmaker herself and a very honorable person. She may have some suggestions, but if she does, they're all good ideas. And she respects, as I respect her, to each filmmaker that works for her. I'm doing two films that HBO is thinking of supporting, one or the other, or both. One of them is a film of what is so special about New York City. I began filming that already. I filmed a softball team in Central Park of guys in their 70s and 80s, and they've been playing as a team since they were 12 years old. All kinds of pieces of humanity that characterize New York City as being so special. And the other one is a film of my own life. I call it Handheld. And so one of those two, I think she's going to okay, and I'll make it for HBO.
Over the years, you've worked with an extraordinary group of editors at Maisel Films, extraordinary group of women mostly. Let me combine that with a question from the internet. In the editing of Give Me Shelter, the editing is quite stylized, this questioner asks, how does the editing affect the feeling of fantasy versus reality in a documentary?
Well, I wish that Charlotte Swear and the editor
Charlotte Swear were great
around.
Editor.
She's a great editor. She did the editing. She'd be best at answering that.
What is your relationship? How do you work with the editors?
Well, for one thing, unlike perhaps most documentary filmmakers, when we give directorial credit, it's for myself, it's for the producer usually, and certainly we include the editor, not always that being the case. But the editor, as well as the camera person, are so crucial to the character of the finished product that they should get that major credit. I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me take it one step further. You go out and you gather footage. You gather 10 hours or 100 hours or 1,000 hours. That comes back into the editing room, either all at once or over a space of 20 years. What's the process? Does the editor look at all the footage and then present a plan to you? Do you present a plan to the editor? How does it work?
I leave the editing pretty much in the hands of the editor. When my brother and I worked together for so many years, he would exercise his authority and supervise the editing. But still, the editor was largely in control. And the thing is to choose an editor who is so careful in examining the original material that he or she very skillfully maintains the essential character of what was in the mind of the camera person when the camera work was being done.
Question from the audience. This person says, I understand you at one point were working on a film about food. Is this true? It seems that everyone's working on a film about food. What is the status of that film?
It's unfinished. There was an enormous assembly of food experts in the mall in Washington, D.C. several years ago. And they were all concerned with the fact that we have lost social contact with food, that one member of the family does all the cooking rather than maybe two or three, the dinner table, people don't socialize, they stop talking. Not in all cases, but that seems to be something going on. And so there was a lot of that sort of thing that we filmed, but this was an occasion where we never got the financing, and I'm still waiting to do my train film. The train is in the station, and I'm waiting for the financing. Every once in a while, I think I'm going to get it, and then it drops out. In fact, you'll get a kick out of this one. There was a front page article in Forbes magazine stating that there are some 1,127 billionaires in the world, any one of which could pay for my train film.
Well,
so I went through that list, and I'm working at it very carefully to see. I discovered that Ralph Lauren has a son who is a filmmaker. So I've contacted him, and I'm seeing him in 2 weeks.
Well, we are, for all practical purposes, out of time. I want to suggest that if everyone in this room reached for your checkbook collectively, we could, in fact, finish that train film right here today. Our thanks to Albert Maysles. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and on the internet. I'm John Else, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is now adjourned.